We accepted a challenge of the scripture, a challenge explicitly stated in Isaiah, where the Lord says, "Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, you who seek the Lord, listen to me. Look to the quarry from which you were hewn, and to the rock from which you were cut. Look to Abraham, your father." And we have taken up that challenge. And we have indeed, for some 6 weeks now, been looking at Abraham. And we will continue that today and for a great while to come. I've entitled what I want to talk about today, Choices, Choices. And I want to read one of my favorite poems, which will set the topic in a very beautiful way. This is a poem by Robert Frost, and I've loved it for many years, called "The Road Not Taken." Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the underground. Then took the other as just as fair and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Frost describes in a very evocative way something with which we are all familiar. Here he pictures it as coming in the woods to a divergence of paths, and he stands at the point of decision, very aware that he could go this way or he could go that way. And he ponders with himself. He said he looked down one as far as he could see until it disappeared and wondered if he should go there. It seemed well trodden. But then he said, no, I'll save that for another day. But then he reflected, well, maybe I'll probably never come back to this place again, so likely I'll not make that choice. And he said, I decided to choose the other one. And then he reflects a bit on it and he says, years and years from now, I will be thinking of this moment with a sigh. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. I don't suppose I have to convince anyone that life is a series of decisions and choices. Every day we are confronted with them. Now, some of them are of very little consequence. It really will not affect your destiny greatly if you choose vanilla ice cream over chocolate. But there are other decisions that clearly and evidently will affect the course of one's life. I'm thinking back. I'm thinking of the choice of a college. Well, that was a major decision at that point in my life. And there were a number of colleges that I considered. But I decided on one. And I think even then I was perfectly aware that that was a momentous decision. Because in all likelihood, 4 years in a school would give me plenty of opportunity to make firm friendships, some that would last the whole course of my life. I would meet one set of people rather than another set of people. Had I gone to another school, I would have met another whole group of people that I will never know. So you see, it was a decision that in some way was bound to affect my life, quite apart from the quality of the education which might be received at any of the schools. Just the relationships that are established because one decision is made rather than another one is very clear to us. 30 years ago, I chose one person to be my wife. And I've always explained it this way. Some of you have heard me say that. To make that choice was at the same time to choose to marry nobody else. Well, obviously, a decision of that nature is bound to affect one's whole life. That is one of those decisions that affects many other decisions later on in life. Just think of it. Had I not chosen the wife I did, I wouldn't have the children I have. Had I married somebody else, they would have been different. Unthinkable. Everything would have been different had I made another choice at that point. I don't need to labor this point. I think you see it very, very clearly. What I want to do today is to look at an incident in the life of Abraham, particularly Abraham's nephew Lot. This comes in the story of Abraham, and a good deal of attention is given to it because I think of the immense importance of the account. And I'm going to try to picture the story for you as a drama in four acts. Now, unfortunately, it is a tragedy. It doesn't end all that well. I wish it would be possible for me at the conclusion of what I'm going to say to you this morning to draw it all together with a great burst of inspiration and send you out walking on cloud nine. But I can't do that today. That's not the nature of this particular story. However, I believe and I pray that the truth will be equally emphatic and will make its imprint on your soul and on your heart and on your mind and on your life. First, I need to go back and establish a few relationships in Abraham's family. Will you turn to Genesis chapter 11, please? You'll find Bibles in the pews if you didn't bring one. Genesis chapter 11. Of the three sons of Noah that succeeded him, one was Shem. One of the descendants of Shem was a man by the name of Terah, T-E-R-A-H. We're introduced to him in verse 27. This is the account of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Three sons, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran became the father of Lot. Now, Haran then was Abram's brother. This means that Lot was Abram's nephew. These relationships are important. While his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldeans in the land of his birth. This means when Abram and his father Terah and his nephew Lot, his wife Sarai and others, left Ur of the Chaldees in response to the call of God, that mysterious awakening in him that God was calling him to leave his country, his people, and his father's house, and go to a land that the Lord said, I will show you. Before they left, his brother Haran had died in the homeland. Lot, however, perhaps because he was bereft of his father, went along with his uncle. Abram and Nahor both married. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Now, Milcah was the daughter of Haran. That means that Nahor married his niece. It's all very complicated. The father of both Milcah and Iscah. Now I read that because you can see that Haran had three children. One was a boy by the name of Lot. Two were daughters by the names of Milcah and Iscah. Now, that is the relationship that I want to establish and that you might know a little bit about this man, Lot. Because this story that we're going to be considering today really centers around him. But of course, Abram is brought into it. Last time, we found Abram wandering in the land of deception. He had lied, he had deceived, and he went down to Egypt and was ceremoniously kicked out by the Pharaoh, who at that time was more righteous than he. He came back to the land, indeed all the way back to Bethel, where he had built an altar to the Lord. Having wandered and sojourned in a foreign land, away from the will and the purpose of God, where he got in trouble, he had to go back and reestablish himself with his God. And he went back to Bethel. And there it says, he called upon the name of the Lord. Now we pick up the story at verse 5 of chapter 13. In verse 2, we find Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold. Perhaps you remember one of the things that he said to his wife Sarah when they got down into Egypt. He said, tell them you are my sister, not my wife. Tell them you are my sister. And so she did. And Pharaoh took Sarah into his own household. And we read in chapter 12 that Pharaoh actually befriended Abram on her account. Verse 16, he treated Abram well for her sake. And Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, men servants and maid servants, and camels. In other words, he gained a great deal of wealth while he was down in Egypt. By the way, one of the maid servants he picked up down there, a servant for his wife, was Hagar, who became the mother of Abram's first child. That never might have happened had they not gone down there. There were all kinds of reasons why Abram should not have gone to Egypt. Anyway, he came back a wealthy man. Now, chapter 13, verse 5. Now Lot, who was moving about with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents. Both of them were wealthy. Remembered, wealth in those days was measured largely in terms of cattle, in terms of flocks, and tents. Now, tents, of course, also implies people to live in the tents. Servants, men servants and maid servants. Verse 6, but the land could not support them while they stayed together, for their possessions were so great that they were not able to stay together. And quarreling arose between Abram's herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. The Canaanites and Perizzites were also living in the land at that time. Now, it's very easy to see that in a land with a very limited supply of green grass and a very limited supply of water would not be able with ease to support large flocks and many large flocks. And that was the source of the problem. Their wealth was excessive. And particularly, the land was unable to support both Lot's herds and the herds of Abram. And quarreling began among the servants. Well, now, when that happens, oftentimes it will filter up until it gets to the masters. And it's very interesting that the writer says that the Canaanites and Perizzites were in the land at that time. It seems to say that had there been division, important division, between Lot and Abram, that this would be all that was needed for the inhabitants of the land to mount an attack on them, and because they were divided, perhaps to spoil them and even defeat them. Anyway, Abram is the first one to suggest something to do about the situation. Verse 8, so Abram said to Lot, let's not have any quarreling between you and me, or between your herdsmen and mine, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Let's part company. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. Now, that's an extraordinary thing. Remember, Abram was unquestionably the patriarch. He was the oldest one. Remember, when they left Haran, he was 75 years old. He was the father's, Lot's father's brother. He was clearly the patriarch. In those days, that was a very important position. Nobody would have expected him to give away the first choice. It would have been perfectly proper for Abraham to say, well, this is where I'm going to settle. Where do you want to settle? But notice, if you will, something of the character of the man who said to his young nephew, you choose first. Any place you decide is all right. I'll take what's left over. If you choose the left, then I'll go to the right. If you choose the right, then I'll go to the left. An extraordinary act of generosity on the part of Abraham. Lot looked up and saw that the whole plain of the Jordan was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt toward Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now, if you go to Bethel today, it is a particular spot high in the mountains. And from the eminence of Bethel, it is possible to see a magnificent view of the whole of the Jordan Valley at your feet. Very likely that is the place where Abram and Lot stood. And it says that Lot looked out. He looked at the mountain country right around him there. And then he looked at the great and fertile valley of the Jordan. He observed that it was a very beautiful land, that it was well watered, and that it was a very fertile land, very desirable, even likened it to the garden of God. Well, if you have the choice, why not choose the best? Probably that thought went through Lot's mind. Anyway, he chose the valley. That was all right with Abraham. He said, all right, I'll settle up here on the mountaintop. But that isn't all it says. It says that he pitched his tent among the cities of the plain and near Sodom. Now, you need to know something of the geography of that portion of the land, because this is very significant indeed. Perhaps you understand that Mount Hermon in the north of Israel, today that great mountain stretching some 9,000 feet in height, stands at the joining place of Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. Parts of that mountain belong to each of those three countries. But that mountain is the beginning of the Great Jordan Rift. And that rift is one of the great, in fact, in many ways, it is the greatest valley in the whole of the earth. It is an immense scar on the face of the earth. If you see it from outer space, and pictures have been taken of it, you see this deep scar in the earth. It stretches all the way from Mount Hermon in the north, clear down to the south of Kenya in East Africa. That great valley, massive feature on the earth's surface. And as the Jordan Valley begins, it plunges quickly downward and downward. When you get to the Sea of Galilee, so important in the ministry of Jesus, you are already 600 feet below sea level when you get to the Sea of Galilee. Then between Galilee and the Dead Sea is a distance of about 75 miles. But in that 75-mile stretch of space, the valley plunges down, down, down to the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is the lowest place on the face of the earth. It's 1,303 feet below sea level. There is no place on earth that is lower than that. Now, in that 75 miles between the Sea of Galilee in the north and the Dead Sea is the part known as the Jordan Valley. The Jordan River runs from off the sides of Mount Hermon in the north and finally empties in to the Dead Sea. Now, if you follow the bank of the Jordan River, although it's 75 miles as the crow flies, it's actually 200 miles because it just winds round and around and around. But because of that, it makes the valley a very fertile place. And historians tell us that once it was far more fertile than it is even today. Well, now, the importance of that is this. That is what Lot saw when he stood with Abram in Bethel. And that is what he chose. No doubt that is the place where his flocks and his herds would be kept. But you'd have to understand, it says that Lot himself moved down toward Sodom and pitched his tent near Sodom. Well, Sodom is at the southern end of the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is 75 miles long. And the Jordan Valley, the part that is fertile, ends with the Dead Sea. There's no fertility beyond that point. So that's the place that he chose. But he himself didn't live there. In fact, he went all the way down to the end of the Dead Sea, 75 more miles, until he came to the city of Sodom. Now, interestingly, by his choice, he chose to move out of the land of promise. Now, he kept the land for his flocks, but he himself pitched his tent, it says, near Sodom. Now, we have a one-sentence description of Sodom in verse 13. Now, the men of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. You see, that city already had a reputation long before Lot got there. Lot knew the kind of city it was, and yet he chose to live near it. And I have to tell you, that was a fatal choice that made all the difference. You see, he chose to move away from the land of promise, the land of Canaan. Instead, he removed himself way below that and located himself next to a pagan city. Well, interestingly enough, now Abram and Lot are separated and forever. Oh, they see each other, but they are basically separated, never again really to be joined. Now, one might wonder about this because Abram was told to leave his country, his people, and his father's house. He did leave his country, he did leave his people, but he did not leave his father's house. He took his father along with him, and he took his nephew. And that was a bad choice, because we read that on the way to the promised land, they settled in a town by the name of Haran. That has nothing to do with his brother, by the way. And it says they settled there. They were not to do that. That was not the land of promise. But you see, Abram was delayed because of his partial obedience. And he had to wait there, we are told, until his father died. When his father died, then again the word of the Lord came to him. He picked up and went on. Well, now he has Lot with him. Lot is part of his father's house. And now through this choice that Lot has made, Lot is now separated from him. And the word of the Lord comes to him again. Verse 14. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, lift up your eyes from where you are and look north and south, east and west. All the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go, walk through the length and breadth of this land, for I am giving it to you. He restates the promise of the land. Twice before he has referred to it. In chapter 12, verse 1, he says, I want you to go to a land that I will show you. Later on in chapter 12, he says, this land I'm going to give you. In this passage, he says, I'm going to give it to your descendants forever. Now, I'm not going to talk about that promise today. I'm going to talk about that promise next Tuesday. The statement of the Lord to Abram is, I'm going to give it to you and your descendants forever. And I'm going to ask the question and answer it next week. Does that have any relevance to the situation in the Middle East today? I don't want to deal with that today. I will deal with that next week. But you can see where it arises. All right, that's the first act. The first act finds Abram and Lot, both wealthy men in terms of possessions, herds, flocks, and servants. They cannot settle in the same place. It simply will not support them. Abram gives his nephew the first choice, who chooses the Jordan Valley. But he then goes down and lives himself near Sodom. The second act we read about in chapter 14. Now, I don't want you to get bogged down with unpronounceable names. I simply want to sketch what it's telling us. It's telling us that four kings fight against five kings for supremacy. Now, a king in this sense and at this time in history is not the ruler of a great nation. You need to understand. The king here would be rather like a mayor in our sense, although with more power, I suspect. Because it was the king, not of a country, but of a city, a kind of city-state, or even more like a tribal chieftain. And there was war. Four of these tribal chieftains, called kings, coalesced together around the strongest and attacked the five. All of them were kings of the Jordan Valley. It was all that area that was settled. And that's where the war went on. Now, one of the consequences of that war we read about in verse 11. The four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food. Then they went away. They also carried off Abram's nephew Lot and his possessions since he was living in Sodom. Now, I don't suppose there ever would have been preserved a record of that squabble in the Jordan Valley nearly 4,000 years ago. What value would there be of telling us about that were it not for this little bit that it tells us about Lot? It says that in the battle, the four kings were victorious. They went as far south as Sodom and Gomorrah, two cities south of the Dead Sea. And it says they captured them and took into captivity all of their goods, brought them back. And among them, it says, they also carried off Abram's nephew, Lot, and his possessions, since he was living, what? In Sodom. That represents a change. In the first act, he pitches his tent near Sodom. But by the time the kings of the plain come and attack the city, he is now living in Sodom. Well, what do we know about Sodom? It was a most evil place. It was wicked and had such a reputation. And Lot, you see, is moving closer and closer. He's making decisions that are disastrous. He's making choices that will indeed make all the difference later on. You'll see that. Well, Abram immediately comes to his rescue. Verse 13, one who had escaped came and reported this to Abram, the Hebrew. Now, Abram was living near the great trees of Mamre, the Amorite, a brother of Eshcol and Anar, all of whom were allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his relative, that's Lot, had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now, stop right there. 318 trained men. Very interesting that it should give the precise number. Where did all these people come from? Well, we find out in chapter 12 that when Abram left Haran and came to Canaan, verse 5 of chapter 12, he took his wife Sarah, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired. Chapter 13 says Abram had become very wealthy in livestock and in silver and gold and had many tents. So you see, over the years, as he was beginning to accumulate wealth, he was also beginning to accumulate servants, many servants. And 318 of them, apparently, were trained men. He had his own little militia. And he dispatched them to go after his nephew. It said they pursued them as far as Dan. Some of you know that the borders of the Promised Land are sometimes referred to as from Dan to Beersheba. Dan is the northernmost point. Beersheba is the most southerly point. Dan is actually located on the side of Mount Hermon in the north. And those who went with us on our trip to Israel a month ago will know that we stopped at Tel Dan. We stopped right at the city, the ruins of the city that was called Dan. Later on, hundreds of years later, during the period of the divided kingdom, one of the worst kings Israel ever had built a great statue and commanded that worship be offered to this statue in Dan. That was one of the places that the idol was set up, and it became a snare to the people of Israel. So Dan represented the northernmost border, and Abraham's militia pursued them all the way, the kings, all the way to that place. And it says, during the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. Act 2 finds Lot living now in Sodom, not next to it or near it, but in it. And when the war takes place, he is a casualty. He and his possessions are taken into captivity. And word of this comes to Abraham, and he dispatches his army to get him back, which he does. That's the second chapter. Now, the third act is found in chapter 19. Unfortunately, the story gets worse and worse. And I'm doing this particular series from the New International Version, which is a splendid translation of the Bible, but it's a very direct translation, as you will see. Verse 1, the two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. Now, that may seem innocent enough to you, and you may not realize what that tells us. You would need to know in ancient times, the gate of the city was the place of local power. That's where the elders of the city met. That's where the court was held. That's where all important things transpired. That's where the patriarchs of the tribe would meet, at the gate of the city. We're already seeing that Lot, who moved first near Sodom and then he moved into Sodom, has now become a substantial citizen in that place, so much so that he is in the gate. Now, I want to illustrate, don't turn to this, but I'll just read it to you. You can see this emphasis upon the gate as a place of significance in the book of Ruth, chapter 4. Let me read a few verses. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here." And they did so. Now, all of this transpired at the gate because Boaz, you see, was a leading citizen of that town. And he was among the elders. Well, this tells us then, this innocent statement, Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. Nobody might take thought of it unless you understood that there's significance to the place he sat. I mean, he just wasn't sitting down resting himself. He was a substantial citizen in that city. When he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. "My lords," he said, "please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night and then go on your way early in the morning." Lot, moved with some compassion upon these travelers, invited them to come to his house. He offered them hospitality. He said, "You can come and wash your feet and you can spend the night and then go on your way early in the morning." "No," they answered, "we will spend the night in the square." In other words, we will pitch our own tent in the square of the city. But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. They called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." I told you this was a direct translation. Some of you have heard the word sodomy. The word sodomy is a word for homosexual relationships. And the word sodomy comes from the city of Sodom and from this particular biblical incident. You see, what happened was Lot welcomed these visitors into his house. And it says that night, it says all the men of the town, both old and young, came to him and demanded that he bring those two men out that they might have sex with them. That's exactly the way it says it. You see, Sodom was a hotbed of homosexual relationships. That's what it was. And it says for earlier on, as we have seen, that the whole city was permeated by wickedness in the sight of the Lord. Well, you can imagine the consternation for Lot. Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, "No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. No, my friends. No, my friends." You see, Lot has begun to make a series of choices that gets him deeper and deeper and deeper. First, he chose a good place to live. But then he moved next to a city that he knew was an evil and wicked place. Then he moved into the city. Then he became a leader in the city. And of course, he was friends with other people of the city. And he says, "No, my friends, don't do such a terrible thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you and you can do what you like with them. But don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof." Such was the honor of Lot at this point that he would prefer, rather than violate the protective custody that he felt because of guests who had come into his home, he had rather give them his daughters. Now, you may think that's a strange exchange, but at least it tells you something. It tells you of how horrified Lot was at what was happening and to what desperate measures he was prepared to go. But look at the result. "Get out of our way," they replied. They said, "This fellow came here as an alien." That's Lot. "And now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them." They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. They didn't want his daughters. They weren't interested in his daughters. They wanted those two men. That's what they wanted. "Get out of the way." But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so they could not find the door. The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in this city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against its people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry, get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished." When he hesitated, the men grasped his hands and the hands of his wife and the two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, "Flee for your lives. Don't look back. Don't stop anywhere on the plain. Flee to the mountains, or you will be swept away." But Lot said, "No, my lords, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life. But I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. Look, here's a town near enough to run to, and it's small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared." He said to him, "Very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow that town you speak of, but flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it." People, I want you to understand that tragic scene. I want you to see what happened to a man who made what might have looked like a relatively innocent choice. When offered the opportunity to decide where he would live, he chose the best place. Well, that's all right. A little selfish, perhaps, but that's all right. But he wasn't satisfied with that. He moved 75 miles away from where his flocks were. You see, he was a gentleman farmer, you understand. He had lots of servants to tend his flocks. And he moved near a city with an evil reputation. You see, he'd made a decision. And there are decisions that we make that begin to be irreversible. Oh, they're reversible for a time. I suppose there is a place where you can swim in safety in the Niagara River. But if you get too close to the falls, there comes a point where you can do nothing about it. You will be brought and you will plunge over the falls if you get too close to it. One can swim in safety in the edge of a whirlpool, but you move and you begin inexorably to be drawn into its vortex. It's unavoidable. You see, when you make choices that you know are evil, you are on dangerous ground because you're moving towards certain and sure disaster. Don't think you can beat the Lord. There's no way you can beat the Lord. Do I have to tell you? There isn't an alcoholic in the world who set out to be an alcoholic. Nobody. There's not a drug addict anywhere that set out to be a drug addict. That just isn't the way it happens. And there is a time, I'm sure, when you could take a drug or you could take alcohol and you could take it or leave it. There's a period of time when that's true. But you see, there's something about that that gets hold of a person. And you move closer and closer and closer, and something happens to you. You lose your ability to choose. You begin to be bound by that which you freely chose at one point. You get to a place where you can't help yourself. And then you're moving swiftly towards an inevitable destruction. That's just the way it is. That's the way it is with any sin, people. Any sin deliberately chosen and moving toward begins to draw us in inexorably towards the center, that place of destruction. That's just the way it works. Well, look what happened to him. He got in the town. He became a big man in town. Even though these people came to do a despicable thing, he called them his friends. I mean, what kind of friends did he keep? That's another thing. The choice of friends can make or break a person. I don't need to tell you that. You may think that you're going to influence them for the good, but oftentimes it's exactly the reverse. You are drawn in further and further along, and you move closer and closer to the edge. Well, what happened? Well, the two men pulled Lot back into the house and said to him, look, do you have any relatives in this city? Any relatives at all? Do you have sons? Do you have daughters? He said, yes, I do. He said, I have two daughters and the two men that they're going to be married to and my wife. Well, he says, get them out of this town. God is going to destroy it. And so quickly he goes and he talks to his future sons-in-law and tells them, this town's going to be destroyed. Well, I mean, they thought he was joking. I mean, why would they believe a thing like that? I'm sure it looked a very secure city, and you couldn't pry them out of the place. Why, that's a harebrained thing to believe. This city's going to be destroyed? And so what happened? He comes back. He's unable to do it. Now, he doesn't leave himself. Lot doesn't pack his bags and leave, even though the two men say, get out of here and get out of here quick because God is going to destroy it. Did you notice it said that the two men had to pull him, had to take them by the hand and drag them out? You see, he had fallen in love with the place. I mean, he had vested interests there. I suppose he might have had businesses in Sodom. He certainly had a home there. All of his friends were there. He was very reluctant to leave. He didn't want to leave. Now, the New Testament tells us that the filthy action and language of the people of Sodom vexed the soul of Lot. The New Testament tells us that. But not enough to separate himself from it. And so, you see, he had invested so much in the place, even though the whole place was under the threat of judgment, he didn't want to go. He just didn't want to go. And they literally dragged him from the city. That speaks to me of the ambivalence, you see, of bondage to sin. I think an alcoholic hates it and loves it at exactly the same time. A drug addict can hate what's happening to him, but can love it. You see, they lose the ability to decide and to choose, and that strange thing happens to them. As you get closer and closer to destruction, you find yourself falling in love with that which is luring you on to destruction. That's just the way it works. Well, the two men say, flee to the mountains. And Lot says, oh, no, I can't go to the mountains. Here's a little town right here. Let's stop here. I mean, can you believe it? With all that he's been through and all that he's been told, he doesn't want to go that far away. Perhaps he's thinking to himself, well, you know, I can go back after this whole thing's over. After things cool down a little, I'll go back. He just couldn't extricate himself. See the pathetic state in which he was. Even though he knew the judgment of God, even though he knew the evil around him, he just could not bring himself to get away. And that happens, people. There comes a point at which you toy with death to the point that it even seems attractive to you. Satan is a liar, and he's a deceiver, and he will use anything to lure you away from obedience to the Lord. Anything, anything. We read that his wife did turn around and look back at the city. I want to read that to you. Again, it's a pathetic thing. No, my lords, verse 18. Please, your servant has found favor. I can't flee to the mountain. Let me settle down in this little village. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. One wonders, I mean, as they were fleeing, I can imagine how Lot might have said to himself, I wonder what's happening to my house. I mean, he could hear this noise behind him. I wonder what's happening to my house. And what about my property? And it could have been irresistible to his wife. I mean, just, you know, one look. What is there in a look? Well, what's in a look? A decision to keep the connection between that which you are fleeing from. Don't even look back. Move away as fast as you can. You're on dangerous ground. That's the third act, and it's a tragic act. Tragic act. Poor Lot, so in love with Sodom that even though it came under the judgment of God, he could barely tear himself away to be rescued reluctantly by the hand of those whom the Lord had sent. The fourth act is even worse. Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains. Finally, they did get to the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. One day, the older daughter said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is no man around us to lie with us, as is the custom all over the earth. Let's get our father to drink wine and then lie with him and preserve our family line through our father." That night they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went in and lay with him, and he was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. The next day the older daughter said to the younger, "Last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight, and you go in and lie with him, so we can preserve our family line through our father." So they got their father to drink wine that night also. And the younger daughter went and lay with him. Again, he was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. He's the father of the Moabites of today. The younger daughter also had a son, and she named him Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites of today. Terrible scene. Lot now is involved in incest. Well, you might say, well, poor thing, he didn't know about it. Well, that may be true. But what happened to his daughters? What happened to his daughters? You see, when Lot made his decision to move into Sodom, it wasn't a decision that affected only him. It affected his children as well. It affected his children as well. You see, our decisions to sin don't only affect us. They affect other people. And that's what happened in this case. You see, so perverted were they in their thinking that they presumed that that would be the way to carry on the line. You remember that Lot was the only boy in the family, and he had only two daughters. So that when Lot died, that's the end of the family, that particular branch of the family. And they presumed to preserve his line in that way, and gave birth to people known as the Moabites and the Ammonites, both of them bitter enemies of the covenant people in later generations. You see, that decision so innocently made, that choice made years ago to move next to Sodom, was a tragic choice that affected generations of people yet unborn. He couldn't have known that back then, but you can. You see, the Bible doesn't try to hide or mask the sins of the saints. And wise is that man and that woman who can profit from the mistakes of others as well as from the triumphs of others. My prayer is, people, that you will be among the wise today. Father in heaven, as you see this congregation, as you see my heart, the heart of each one of us here, you know when we have pitched our tent toward Sodom. You know when we have chosen deliberately to go near that which is not pleasing in your sight. And we beg your forgiveness for every act of disobedience. And Lord, we understand the power and the attraction of that which is evil in your sight. And sometimes it is frightening to realize what we are capable of as a result of our own choices. We cast ourselves on your mercy. Lord, as you look upon us, there may be people today, this very day, who are near a place from which there is no return. Perhaps only you know, Lord. I pray that you will let your word enlighten their decisions. I pray that it may embolden people to come back, to return to that place of promise and blessing when they may have been wandering in a foreign land. And I ask that this drama in four acts may be indelibly impressed upon each one of us. I know you've spoken to me in reference to it. I pray you will speak to everyone. In the name of Jesus, amen.